I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia in the Arts Cafe of the Kelly Writers House by Tom Devaney, poet, critic, teacher, reviewer extraordinaire, whose latest book of poems is A Series of Small Boxes. And by Bob Perlman, longtime Penn colleague from the Bay Area, of course, before that, author most recently of a book of poems, If Life, published by Roof Books, which we celebrated here at the Writer's House when it came out and recorded the reading for Bob's great Penn Sound page, to which I happily direct everyone within earshot. And by Tom Mandel, Chicago kid who studied with Arendt and Bellow at U of C there, later part of the Bay Area scene where he was at some point director of the Poetry Center of San Francisco State. How many years, Tom?
Oh, just 1 year.
Just 1 year. That was long enough. One of the authors.
It was an action-packed year, yes.
One of the authors, along with Bob Perlman, among others, of The Grand Piano, an experimental collective autobiography, whose recent book, To the Cognoscenti, was published in 2007. Tom works in social software and new media as an entrepreneur and tech industry consultant. Welcome back to you, Bob and Tom. And thanks, Tom Mandel, for making your way to Philly from Delaware via Detroit.
And Chicago.
And Chicago, and for joining us on Poem Talk for the first time. How is Detroit and Chicago?
Well, I went to Detroit for a grand piano reading, which was an enormous amount of fun. There were seven of us. Unfortunately, Bob couldn't make it. Seven of us were there, and we just had a fabulous time, gave a really terrific reading, which someday soon, probably within the week, will be available to listen to and maybe even a video to watch.
That's great.
At the Grand Piano
website. The subject of our discussion today, Lynn Hajinian, was there?
Yes, she was.
That's
certainly
great. Our poem today is an untitled 27-line lyric by Lynn Hajinian, the aforementioned, which has been published once in a magazine and I think later in an anthology, but has not been collected in a book. Now, that volume, A Decade in Progress, is to be called The Book of 1,000 Eyes and will possibly consist of 1,000 poems or maybe 310, which is how many were complete the last time I checked with Lynn. A handful of pieces from the project appeared in The Little Book of 1,000 Eyes, published by Smokeproof Press, but our poem does not appear there. We'll call it Constant Change Figures from its first line, and our recording comes from a visit Lynn Hajinian made here to the Writer's House in February 2005 when she read this one and 20 other poems in the series. So here now is Lynn Hajinian reading Constant Change Figures.
Constant change figures the time we sense, passing on its effect, surpassing things we've known before, since memory of many things is called experience. But what of what we call nature's picture, of the many things we call, since memory we call nature's picture, surpassing things we've known before, constant change figures, experience passing on its effect. But what of what constant change figures, since memory of many things is called the time we sense, called nature's picture. But what of what in the time we sense, surpassing things we've known before, passing on its effect is experience.
The first line, the word figures, is read as if by Lynn as if it's a noun.
Oh,
but
no,
it strikes
I think it's
me
read as
a verb.
If it's a verb. In the first time through, I think it's read as if it's a
how
verb.
How does it work, Tom?
I think it's read as if it's a verb the first time through, as if it's a noun the second time, and in the exact same pronunciation as when it was a noun, as a verb the third time.
When it functions as a verb, what does it do? Let's say in the first couple of lines.
What does it do semantically?
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Semantically, it says that that change is what decorates, presents, and makes available to us the time we sense.
Constant change figures the time we sense, passing on its effect, surpassing things we've known before, since memory of many things is called experience.
So it figures time.
It figures time.
Bob, yeah. what do you make of that particular repetition, constant change figures?
Oh, I make a lot of things. I'm thinking how different it is looking at the poem on the page, hearing the poem, and then remembering the poem. It changes quite dramatically, it seems to me, in those various instantiations. So, no, I totally agree with what Tom says about the play between process and product, between fluidity and solidifying into gestalt, and that's what she's doing throughout. I think the poem contains the seeds of its own unfolding and self-undoing and redoing, and is trying to teach us as it goes along how to read, unread, reread it.
Tom Devaney, what is your sense of hearing the poem? Does the sound wash over you? Do you forget the obligation to pull a semantic meaning of it, since it's obviously repeating lines and one has a feeling that maybe randomly it's doing so?
No, you feel the repetition, that kind of insistence of new meaning in each line, each time, the constant change figures. She's enacting that feeling of, you know, the Steinian, nothing can be repeated, only said with a different insistence. So that's the feeling I get right away, and kind of giving you that feeling on the page of what the memory process feels like, this through wordplay, repetition.
Tom Mandel, you look like you're...
Yeah, I am. I would like to just say that there's plenty of gestalt in the poem. The poem is three sets of nine lines.
Right.
The first set of nine is repeated in the second set and the third set with significant variation. In the second set, the first line appears twice, and the second line, the time we sense, does not appear at all. In the second set of the third nine, the second time that she's repeating, the second line, the time we sense, appears twice, whereas the first line, constant change figures, doesn't appear.
Is there an algorithm?
There's not an algorithm. There doesn't need to be an algorithm. There is a clear pointing being made. First of all, to the, if you will, leading position of the first two lines, constant change figures the time we sense, as in a way the seed out of which the whole poem proceeds. And those two lines, constant change figures and the time we sense, are repeated significantly differently from the other lines in the poem.
You know, it's funny thinking, I mean, I know Stein is...
back there somewhere.
Is back there somewhere, is, you know, crucial to Lynn's writing. And then there's Stein's continuous present, which this poem certainly is an example of. But it's also, I think, a kind of a meta commentary on continuous present, because it's not simply a continuous present. There's three different modes of time. I mean, there's sense, there's experience, and there's memory. I mean, sense might be the immediate sensory present, hearing each word. And the way Lynn reads it, at first she really emphasizes the line breaks.
Constant change figures the time we sense, passing on its effect, surpassing things we've known before. Since memory of many things is called experience, but what of what we call nature's picture?
So sense would break things down into the present, tend to break things into smaller and smaller atoms. Experience is a longer mid-range present. It's as if when you hear the whole sentence, that's the experience or the whole poem. So there's the residue, you know, if we all just sort of stop and what do we think about this poem? What's the memory of the poem? And it's a much different being than certainly reading the poem or rehearing it. So I think all of those different instantiations, aspects, states are what the poem is trying to invoke. And I'm now remembering actually one of Lynn's early talks, Chronic Ideas. And I was, when I heard her read the first line, constant change figures, I mean, the constant figures, but change figures, Those are actually chronic ideas
from
30 years ago, mm-hmm. which are so while on the one hand you have a pay-on to change and the constant sliding along of the present, you also have this continuity of the constant going back 30 years.
And I'd also add, just sort of thinking back to language poetry's manifesto moment, if there was such a thing, where you might say, we call memory nature's picture, and we've got to do something different. Let's do something different. The memory isn't so simple, and it's not just Proustian. There's something else going on. Tom Devaney, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not Proustian memory, too. There's a distinction being made, and the whole poem is about differences in that sense. I just really kept thinking about passing on its effect, and Tom's earlier comment, just seeing how the poem was working just like physically on the page. But the poem, for me, feels like passing on its effect. You can feel the effects in the poem enacting, and so I kind of just really like that line, passing on its effect, surpassing things we've known before.
And yet that line also can mean passing on its effects.
Right.
I think I'll pass on that.
Nice.
Yeah.
A lot of these
lines, words, syntactic recursions are a little bit like Freud's primal words, where they also mean their opposite, passing, surpassing. Mm-hmm.
But what in the time we sense, surpassing things we've known before, passing on its effect, is experience.
Experience is constantly qualified in this poem.
But it's the last word in the poem, and the writer knows what she's doing. So that the last question in the last five lines...
It is an implied question, yes.
But what of what in the time we sense, surpassing things we've known before, passing on its effect, is experience. So you can't let that go. And I would just say, as far as the Stein goes, as Steve Lacy says, everything is an influence, and poems are not comments on the relation of a poem to the prior history of literature is really just the price of entrance to thinking about and understanding the poem. So I wouldn't want us to try and to dive too deeply into Lynn and Stein.
Okay, right. So warned.
Okay.
But let me just, getting away from Stein, let me just try, I'm going to do something really stupid, except for pedagogical purposes, and try to paraphrase that fabulous question that ends the poem, mm-hmm. right? And you tell me if I've got it wrong or it makes no sense at all. To what extent is experience, in quotes, so-called, of what we call experience, to what extent is experience the result of our living in time, moment-to-moment duration, which produces senses that are familiar yet move us forward onto new effects? That would be my paraphrase of the question. Or in other words, to what extent is experience the confluence of what we of the present we know and what of the present is new?
But the question...
How did I do?
You did great, except that the frame of the question is, what is experience? But what of what ... is experience?
Of the many things we call, since memory we call nature's picture, surpassing things we've known before, constant change figures, experience passing on its effect. But what of what constant change figures, since memory of many things is called the time we sense, called nature's picture?
But see, I think that there's a harder critique of experience at the beginning of this poem, and we might agree about this. That is to say, this thing we call experience isn't much of a guide to what we know of the present and formulating how we will proceed sort of wholly into the next moment. This thing we call experience. In the end, I think that experience is I think experience is sort of dubbed an ideology. It's a way of thinking that's not necessarily what this poem's going to be about.
Sure.
Yeah, it makes sense?
Yeah.
I remember the first chapters or the first sections of my life. This is Lynn Hajinian essentially trying to imagine the language self as a premature being, I guess you could say. And there's all this Freudian identification language, the memory of, I guess, the pattern of rose on the wall and all that stuff. There's something about this that makes me think of it as a kind of mature lyric contemplation version of the kind of gauzy Proustian baby language self in those first sections. This makes me think of that. It makes me think of my life, only it's more, it's a little more theoretical, a little more abstract, and the language is less concrete.
Constant change figures the time we sense, passing on its effect, surpassing things we've known before. Since memory of many things is called experience, but what of what we call nature's picture?
Can I throw something out that I think we may want to say for any learners out there, sophomores, as it were, symbolically, something we may have not stressed enough, which is that this poem is a perfect example of a poem that is semantically about the way it is as a form. It does. Somebody want to comment on that? It is about how it must change, but it also changes.
Well, even the line that Tom and I easily, had two different readings of, that's an example of the interruption being built within the poem. And it still gives me the effect, whether it's an interruption or not, of like how something's feeling. And so she's like kind of enacting in the language through the insistence that this kind of experience, talking about experience, but creating a new experience in the poem itself and not going outside of that.
It's funny, though. I'm saying this remark looking down at the page, which, again, is cheating from the listener's point of view. But the first four lines, constant change figures the time we sense, passing on its effect, surpassing things we've known before. So by the time you... And in that fourth line, to me, that before gestures to before the poem started. It's a place that actually gestures outside of the poem itself.
Constant change figures, experience passing on its effect. But what of what constant change figures, since memory of many things is called the time we sense, called nature's picture, but what of what in the time we sense, surpassing things we've known before, passing on its effect is experience.
Speaking now more generally about poetry, what is the virtue of a variations poem like this, a poem that reuses its lines and, I suppose, in an oral sense, mesmerizes us?
So probably in some ways in our time, John Coltrane is the great artist of this kind of repetition. One of the things it does is it keeps more of the work in the present, keeps more of the work in the mind of the listener, reader, at any single time.
Keeps us going.
Definitely keeps us going.
It can also, seems to me, be really emphasize that edge of novelty. What's just a little bit different about this, that you just heard this, but you didn't hear it just this way.
Right. Make it new in a different mode,
right.
Surpassing the things we knew before. Well, I can't resist, but although Stein has been
banished.
Jokingly banned.
No.
Lynn Hajinian, in one of her two talks on Stein, which she has reprinted in her wonderful book of essays, The Language of Inquiry, Essays and Poems, she quotes Stein in composition as explanation as follows. It was all so nearly alike, it must be different, and it is different. It is natural that if everything is used and there is a continuous present and a beginning again and again, if it is all so alike, it must be simply different, and everything simply different was the natural way of creating it then. Anybody want to comment on the relevance of that or not relevance?
Yeah, Stein, it's funny how... the first time you hear that, or when it circulates, or when me, for instance, first taught it, you emphasize its break with the long syntactic periods of, say, Henry James or William James. It's the continuous present.
That William James talked about but didn't write like.
Yes. But in fact, Stein is not so un-Jamesian. And she really puts big demands on medium-term memory and comparison. And so the continuous present is a little bit like the greyhound, the rabbit that the greyhounds chase.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the bettors are keeping track of the number of laps that the greyhounds are running to fill out this metaphor. But, there is something, the mid-range attention is very important. Let's go back to Lynn. It's very important in this poem, it seems to me, of try to read this poem as one complete thought, complete sentence, holding the whole thing in that mid-range of your attention. It's kind of a staggering load, but I think it's just barely doable, and it's a very different kind of experience than, say, memory or than sense.
Tom?
And one thing I might add is that this work and much of Lynn's work owes to William James as great a debt, if that's the right word for it, as it does to Stein.
Or through Stein to William James, of course.
Through Stein to William James, directly also.
Yeah, I think it must be said, although this is a little hard bibliographically, that the Book of a Thousand Eyes, which might be 300 poems or 400 poems, but it'll still be probably called the Book of a Thousand Eyes, I've read 30 or 40 of these things and listened to some of them, and it strikes me that she's trying to do not this precisely, but this kind of thing in a lot of these poems. And I can't help but think, and it's very impressionistic, that the book is a kind of cubistic gesture at, all the ways, the thousand ways of looking at a blackbird. This mid-range level of attention you're talking about, tried in many different ways. It's quite an experiment to do this as a series of short poems rather than as a longer one. Well, before we get to the Gathering Paradise segment of our show, let me ask each of you to offer a brief final word on this poem, something maybe more on what you get from it. So who wants to start?
I think there's a sense in which the poem is a capturing of the intention of the poet, and a similar sense in which the poet herself is the intention of the poem. So I just want to say that the thing that stands out for me in the poem, it's a fabulous poem, no question, is the structure of the three different sections. And there's some sense in which the need to account for that takes us completely away from thinking about the history of literature or the influence of a particular player in the history of literature on the work, and puts us in a place where we are alone with those two lines, with the difference that their different positions makes, and with our own lives. And so there you go.
Well argued, in a way, slightly askance, if that's the word, from Bob's idea that we have everything we need in the poem, but there's also a gesture to something that happened before it. It works very well. It's a great argument for an autotelic experience of a poem. Bob.
Well, I want to...
Final word.
I got to, maybe just being a bad boy, I want to bring Stein back one last time.
Just after Tom made this great speech about how it all that we need is...
I love Stein. I'm not being
anti-Stein.
No, I know you aren't.
But here's why. I'm just, again, looking down at the page in that last five lines. What in the time we sense surpassing things we've known before, passing on its effect is experience, and how I'm actually less certain than ever whether that's an assertion or a question. And I'm now thinking of Stein and her, his poetry and grammar, and doing away with as many punctuation marks as possible, including, as I'm maybe wrong about, but I remember her saying question marks, that questions, you should know if it's a question or not. But in fact, here, you don't know if it's a question, and it really could be, you couldn't construe it, I think, as a statement, or what is this experience? What is this poem we've just had? Now we can take Stein back out of it. Never mind. And just, the poem itself is asking that question. But Stein is just a kind of a useful heuristic to...
Following up on Tom and Bob's points, that there are intentions in the poem, and then there's language. And the line that just kept coming up, the time we sense called nature's picture, that line, nature's picture, it's just so, keeps sticking out to me as not something trucked in there. So there's intention, there are intentions, and then there's language. Like, that language is being used to do something.
Thank you, Tom. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail, commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Who wants to gather a little paradise? Bob,
I want to shout out to Ron Silliman's The Alphabet. Just came out recently, a really major event in American
published by Alabama
literary history. Yes, published by Alabama. Good for many years of reading. And can I do two? Just because I had read this, it's been out for years and years, and I finally picked it up. Keith Waldrop's Semiramis, if I remember. I finally read it, and it is, like, fantastic. So just to shout out to that, too.
Thank you, Bob, for those two gatherings of paradise. Tom Devaney?
Bobby Louise Hawkins, one of my new favorite writers. Her book of prose out by United Artists is just so beautiful, so unhampered. She's 81, 82, and I love her.
Well, that's all the octogenarians we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Bob Perlman, Tom Mandel, Tom Devaney, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, James Lemaire, and our Rotterdam-based editor, the infamous Steve McLaughlin. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.